Available now from Graphic Audio.
Attention all hands, attention all hands. This is the captain. I regret to inform all of you that Speaker of the Grand Council, Lord Thornbuckle, is dead. Assassinated on Castle Rock.
It's been confirmed by 3 separate agencies, my lord.
How many were killed or injured?
Lord Thornbuckle and 3 security personnel killed. Sir Mahoney is alive, but in critical condition.
A terrible, terrible situation.
Terrible for some, certainly.
So we're too late and somebody got him first.
So what do we do?
Get the rest of them. If he's dead, maybe they won't be watching so close. I could take that yellow-haired slut.
We have a mission. A new mission. Got it?
Yes, sir.
Miranda, what have they told you about it? About who did it?
Nothing. I know the news media says it was the New Texas Militia.
Miranda, I don't think it was the New Tex Militia.
No.
Since Lord Thornbuckle is dead and cannot reply, some might consider it unnecessary to detail the charges that might have been brought against him, but I believe in full and fair disclosure. The fact is, the Familius Regnant is sick, on its deathbed, and if we don't act quickly, the patient could die.
How did Hobart Consoline become Speaker?
I'm Ranger Briley, but you can call me Kate.
What do you make of our Speaker?
He's nobody I'd buy a ranch from. Now, why don't you get down to what you really wanted to talk about?
I want to find out who killed my father, and what kind of hold Hobart Consoline has on my Uncle Hollis, who's after my father's estate.
Now that's a goal we can work on.
We?
Of course we. Hell's bells, sweetheart. I'm not gonna leave you to hunt this hog alone. It's time I went to work.
Serrano Legacy, Book 6, Change of Command, Part 1, from Graphic Audio.
Graphic Audio presents DC Comics Crisis on Infinite Earths.
Be careful, Barry.
Don't worry, I'll be right back. My God.
Why am I brought from universe to watch his destruction?
Anyone have any idea what this is about?
I am the Monitor, and I brought you here to save the multiverse.
Only then, in a single, swift, and surprising stroke.
I will kill the man I love.
Damn you! I just wanted to see her one more time!
This is war, Superman.
This ends now!
Why are you fighting me? You're already dead!
I need more power! I need more strength!
Time for you, your worlds, and your universes to die!
Iris.
Crisis on Infinite Earths and all names, characters, and elements are trademarks of DC Comics. Copyright 2009 DC Comics. All rights reserved.
Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents Jerry Ahern's The Survivalist. Narrated by Terrence Acil Ford. With performances by Nanette Savard, Michael Glenn, David Coyne, Eric Messner, Elizabeth Jernigan, M.B. Van Dorn, Lily Beacon, Dylan Lynch, Tony Nam, Tom Simpson, Ren Casey, Dolores King-Williams, Michael John Casey, Richard Rowan, James Konacek, and Mort Shelby. Survivalist number 15, Overlord. Predictably, the leader of the reconnaissance patrol had sent one man ahead. John Rourke waited for him in the rocks as the man entered the gorge, the man's assault rifle at the ready. Rourke imagined the man's knuckles would have been white if they could have been seen beneath the heavy winter gloves the man wore. Rourke waited where the gorge narrowed. It was the logical place. The man coming through the gorge ahead of his patrol, if he were any good at all, would anticipate this as the most logical place to be attacked and be doubly vigilant. The gorge was only 8 feet across here, and, logic again dictated, the Soviet trooper would make the wise decision and walk along the precise center, thereby keeping a safe distance from either wall. The gorge walls were pockmarked with indentations, some large enough to hide a man from plain view. It was in one of these where Rourke himself hid. But the angle of the indentation was such that Rourke could, by keeping his face at its very edge, easily observe. The man was some 8 feet back along the gorge, entering into the narrowest part. Rourke could see the man's gloved right first finger edged just outside the trigger guard. John Rourke waited, his fist closing over the base of his knife handle. Beneath the man's chin was a metallic framework, the framework holding a microphone just below the level of the man's lips. The microphone would be on, someone with the main body of the man's unit monitoring the fact that the man kept breathing, listening for some untoward sound that would betray an encounter with foul play, which would then alert the unit. The Soviet soldier was even with Rourke now. The blade tore through muscle, flesh, and bone as the head severed from the body. Rourke, without his customary aviator-style sunglasses, squinted, averting his eyes as the blood spurted from the stump atop the now headless torso.
Damn, I'm good.
John Thomas Rourke had always felt it erroneous to label character traits as good or evil. It was instead how such traits manifested themselves that was subject to moral judgment. Vladimir Karamazov was consistent in his practice of evil. It was another manifestation of Karamazov's consistency for which John Rourke found himself now quite pleased, the predictability of the man. Habitually, as Karamazov's troops moved eastward, Karamazov, or more likely one of his underlings, with Karamazov's full acquiescence, dispatched recon patrols in tandem, going off at oblique angles to the column's line of march and ahead of the slow-moving army. A solitary Soviet gunship would move directly over the line of march and ahead, back and forth, covering the immediate ground over which the column would move. It was one of the twin reconnaissance patrols which Rourke, Natalia Anastasia Temerovna beside him, now observed, the patrol's point man, the soldier whom Rourke had just killed. Rourke looked up from their line of march and across the gorge, which the patrol now entered. He could not see Paul Rubinstein, nor any of the commandos of New Germany. And that was very good. Rourke let his eyes drift past Natalia to a half dozen German commandos, armed, ready. It was a risky operation, but a reconnaissance patrol would possess maps potentially useful as intelligence data, and the officer leading the patrol, and perhaps his senior non-com, would have valuable data in their heads, to be sure. 16 persons attacking 23 men from ambush with the element of surprise in their favor was not the risky part. The risky part was attempting to take as many live prisoners as possible. Immediately after killing the point man, Rourke had plugged his own microphone unit into the belt pack of the dead man's radio, maintaining the regular breathing. And now the faked radio transmission was kept up by a soldier of Argentina's New Germany, who marched on a respectable distance ahead of the Russians he was trying to deceive, marched on in Soviet battle dress utilities, lest Karamazov's roving helicopter should for some reason diverge from its customary path and observe him. John Rourke settled the Steyr-Mannlicher SSG on his shoulder. He settled the crosshairs of the 3x9 variable over the backpack radio being carried by the second man on the far side. It was the patrol radio which could reach the column and summon help. The distance to the column was too great for the sound of gunfire to carry. The Soviet trooper fell forward, his radio backpack shattering, pieces flying everywhere. Rourke was up, handing off the SSG to one of the German commandos, moving, clambering over the rocks behind which they had hidden.
Follow me!
Suppressive fire was coming from the rocks on either side of the gorge. The Russians turned their attention away from Rourke and Natalia and the men with them for a precious instant. Two troopers with portable missile launchers strapped to their backs were starting to run further along the course of the gorge. Rourke swung the muzzle of the M16 toward them.
Rourke, get down!
Natalia's assault rifle opened up a second later. Rourke looked right. The Soviet officer and his non-com were shooting their way out of his trap, running back the way they had come.
Natalia!
Rourke started after them, at the far edge of his peripheral vision, seeing Natalia do the same. As the two men crossed through the narrowest portion of the waste of the gorge, there was a single blur, then another just after it. Cole jumped from the high rocks, tackling the officer, one of the German commandos doing the same, sacking the non-com. Rourke, Natalia beside him, closed quickly with them. Rourke stepped in between Paul and the Russian as the Soviet officer pulled away and started to his feet. The M16's flash deflector clipped the officer at the base of the jaw. Rourke wheeled right, the German commando on his knees, both fists balled as though they held some invisible baseball bat, the fists lacing the Soviet non-com across the mouth as the man tried to get up. The others from Paul's original position on the far side of the gorge had closed with the Russians now, the two elements of the German commando unit having all but subdued the ambushed Russians. It would now be a job for the German truth drugs. John Rourke watched the movement of the Hero Marshal's column. He swept the armored 8x30s along the course of the ridgeline over which the tanks, armored personnel carriers, and armored truck transports moved. Moving along a steep defile toward the ridgeline was a single file of men, two dozen of them, the precise count, when he had last looked. And he counted them again as they trudged slowly upward to intersect the column's line of travel, the column still at least a mile and a quarter away. No men had joined the file or broken away from it. It was the second reconnaissance patrol, the men of the first patrol dead or captured, those captured being interrogated by intelligence specialists. It was one of many reconnaissance patrols Rourke had observed in the weeks since Karamazov's abortive attempt to conquer the Soviet underground city, in the weeks since Karamazov had begun the movement of his vast army to the east. The forces of the underground city seemed to be still recovering from the effects of the gas attack and ground assault, by means of which Karamazov had nearly overthrown his own Soviet communist leaders. What the leadership of the Soviet underground city would decide upon as their ultimate course of future action was as yet uncertain. Because of this, considerable numbers of the forces of New Germany, with whom John Rourke, the Icelandics, and at least in name the leadership of Eden Base had allied, remained in the low ridges and high valleys encamped near the principal entrance to the underground city. Should the Soviet forces there commit to the field, the Germans would be hard-pressed to contain them. With a still smaller force, the Germans monitored the movements of Karamazov's army. Had there been only one force of Russians, it would have been difficult to attack, the odds perilously high in favor of the enemy. But with two enemy forces, and those friendly forces divided, the possibility of attack was non-existent. The Icelandics had no army, no weapons of war except those provided by the Germans since the recently inaugurated alliance, no fighting men except the men of their largely ceremonial police force. John Rourke had not stayed with the German army, which doggedly pursued Karamazov. There had been no imperative. He had flown, instead, directly to the Hekla community in Iceland, where Sarah, his wife, had remained. Rourke had wanted to stay with Sarah, but could not, and because of her pregnancy, she could not accompany him. He had first returned to the retreat in the mountains of northeastern Georgia, taking Michael with him, Paul and Annie staying behind in Hekla with Sarah, Maria Lloyden staying with them. At the retreat, he could only spare 2 days and a night, he had resupplied both the retreat and himself, bringing to it cases of the German-manufactured ammunition for his handguns and long guns, new food supplies, new tires for his vehicles, new belts, new gaskets. Everything that in 5 centuries could have become damaged or potentially unusable, he now replaced. Rourke had taken some necessities from the retreat as well. More of the cigars Annie had faithfully made for him. A new lensatic compass, his having broken during the fighting at the Soviet underground city, an occurrence he had only realized long after it had taken place. And a new knife. They had flown back from the retreat to Iceland. Then, with Paul and Natalia as well, Rourke and his son had returned to the icy wastelands of Europe. Rourke first briefing Sarah and Annie as to the new supplies he had laid in at the retreat. And then Michael, Maria Lloyden, and a team of German commandos had gone on ahead. Rourke's head ached from staring through the binoculars, as he had almost without stop for more than an hour, with no sleep in the last 30 hours, with the fatigue of combat so recently endured. Rourke looked at Natalia beside him as he set the binoculars down on the snow-covered rocks in which they crouched.
You watch that recon patrol for a while.
Why don't you take something for your headache, John?
I can't. I left my pack down there with the Germans.
Instead, Rourke unsheathed the knife he had taken from storage at the retreat from the heavy black leather scabbard on the belt of his Levi's. He felt Natalia's eyes on him for an instant, and he looked over to her, but she had already looked away, peering through the German field glasses she had adopted.
It's curious.
What's curious?
That knife the old gentleman at Hecla gave Michael. A copy of the knife that you had saved for Michael, only smaller. But a copy of the same maker's work. I mean, it is a strange coincidence.
Quality endures.
Rourke slipped the transparent plastic tube from inside the knife's hollow handle, uncorking one end, the end nearest the painkillers, the water purification tablets, and the antibiotic tablets. He took one of the painkillers.
You satisfied?
Yes. How much longer?
Rourke glanced at the black-faced Rolex Submariner on his left wrist. It was 12 past the hour.
3 minutes.
Natalia nodded, her eyes still seemingly glued to the binoculars. It was a psychological victory, which they hoped for, and a tactical victory, in that however much Vladimir Karamazov's march could be slowed, was that much more time in which to anticipate his final objective and somehow take steps to counter it. Time for Michael to perhaps locate Karamazov's objective. Rourke eyed the Rolex again. A minute and a few seconds remained. He turned his body around, crouching now to peer over the rocks. With the naked eye, the snake of Karamazov's column appeared more worm-like, and the 24 men of the 2nd Reconnaissance Patrol seemed little more than stick figures as they struggled upward to reach the ridgeline. Rourke looked still again to his watch. The sweep's second hand was moving inexorably toward the 12. Faintly, perceptible to him perhaps only, because he listened for the sound, came the whining roar of German fighter aircraft, the entire squadron of 6, which had been sent from Argentina to aid their efforts against the Russians. Rourke craned his neck toward the sound, not bothering with binoculars, seeing the gradually growing dark shapes coming in low over the horizon, like streaks of black smoke, growing disproportionately large as they passed overhead. Rourke pulled Natalia down, his right arm coiling around her shoulders, drawing her head against his chest, but he kept his own face just by the lip of the rocks so he could see. The 6 fighter aircraft fired their machine guns, strafing the 24-man patrol, the stick figures scattering like leaves before a strong wind. 5 of the craft flew on. The 6th fighter, however, broke off. It barrel-rolled and banked steeply, flying back. The fighter swept low, a contrail coming from one of the missile pods beneath the portside wing. Then the fighter vanished in the direction of the 5 other fighters, toward Karamazov's column. John Rourke stood and swept the binoculars up, peering through them, Natalia standing beside him now. It would be hit and run, a single pass along the length of the column, then a return pass, and then gone. But it would slow the inexorably advancing column as it made its way.
But toward what?
Michael Rourke stepped down from the German jeep-like vehicle almost before it had stopped. The granite spires and upswept walls of the greater Qing'an range rose before him, an offset spinal column separating Inner Mongolia from Manchuria, separating one near-subarctic expanse of nothingness from another. They had rolled the jeep-like vehicle from its carry position inside the largest of the 3 helicopters that morning and decided to examine the terrain from the ground.
Wild duck chase, hmm?
Goose. But you're probably right, Otto.
Then where are the communists going?
It was Maria Leuden who spoke now. Michael turned and looked at her.
Karamazov cannot be taking his army just nowhere. That would be irrational.
Most likely, yes. If he is moving without a definite geographical goal, we'll all have been operating under misapprehension, a potentially dangerous one.
They were near what, 5 centuries ago, had been the city of Harbin, northeastern China's most important industrial base. But he doubted any of it would remain now. No gutted ruins. But Harbin had drawn him. From his readings in the endless nights of the long years during which his father had returned to the sleep, he had learned that Harbin had been a Russian city in the China of old, the Russians and the industry drawn there by Harbin's uniqueness as a railhead. He had wondered, when Karamazov's line of march had seemed to indicate the direction of China, if somehow Harbin or its environs still possessed something Russian, or something lusted after by the Russians.
He must have a purpose.
Otto.
Michael spoke to the captain of commandos from New Germany in Argentina.
Signal the gunships that were going up into those mountains.
Bjorn Rolvag stroked Hrothgar behind the ears. He sat in the back of the vehicle, watching, slightly nervous as he always was in one of these modern contrivances, but less so in this one, which bumped and jostled over the rocky ground, than in those which flew like great ugly birds in the sky. He watched the young man who successfully ignored him. The young man, an identical duplicate of his father, the great John Rourke, who seemed at once to ignore everything, yet notice everything. Bjorn Rolvag watched Maria Leuden as well. The German was very beautiful, though he considered the trousers she wore, trousers like a man might wear, only tighter fitting, to be immodest. And it was evident, when she looked at Michael Rourke, that she loved him. Bjorn Rolvag somehow felt pity for her because of that. She spoke to him, Rolvag, in dulcet tones, words of which he could understand precious little. But she seemed kind. She would stroke his dog, Hrothgar, beneath the chin, behind the ears, the careless attention of her fingers something the animal seemed to adore. There was great love in her. Maria Leuden huddled inside the coat, but the cold came from within her. She glanced beside her as her gloveless left hand stroked the fur of the mighty animal, wolf-like, but so much like a child, eager for affection. Hrothgar showed no sign of sleeping, though his master was apparently of a different mind. Her eyes drifted forward, settling for a moment on Captain Otto Hammerschmidt, his massive shoulders, his gloved hands smothering the steering wheel. But her gaze shifted to Michael Rourke. His head was obscured by the hood of his parka. His shoulders were equally as massive as those of Hammerschmidt, both men together seeming to be dwarfed by the massiveness of Bjorn Rolvag, who, along with his dog, occupied the rear seat. But unlike Rolvag, Michael showed no signs of being asleep, and unlike Hammerschmidt, there was a tenseness which seemed to radiate from him even when he sat unmoving. She closed her eyes. She could see Michael Rourke, tall, straight, dark brown hair, full. The eyes, penetrating, dark. His muscles rippled beneath his shirt, and he moved with the grace of an animal rather than a mere man. His hands, when he touched her for whatever the reason, she felt inside herself something she had never felt before. If she kept her eyes closed, the image of Michael might remain, and perhaps it would carry her into sleep. There was an advantage to the dresses worn by the women of Iceland, Annie Rourke noted. Though her mother's pregnancy was showing, the high-waisted dresses Sarah Rourke wore effectively camouflaged her condition. Annie longed for the same condition, but had agreed with Paul that they would not have their first child until the thing with Karamazov was over. She felt cheated, having to stay behind while Natalia and even the German girl Maria Leuden went into the field. In part, it was to keep her mother company. In part, that was the reason that she stayed. But in part, it was to keep a Rourke presence in Iceland among the peaceful people who were its inhabitants and the New Germany allies who were its guardians. Madame Jokli had come to rely on her, in fact, in her dealings with the German commander, Major Volkmar, asking her, Annie, to accompany her when necessity demanded going to the German base just outside the cone of the volcano that walled Hekla against the ice and storm of the Arctic environment in which it was an island of warmth and flowers and beauty. And Annie Rourke looked forward to it, as she did now, because the meetings allowed her the opportunity to meet with Dr. Munchen. Munchen always arranging his appointments so they could talk without interruption, disregarding the occasional emergency. Annie had boarded the German helicopter, following closely at Madame Jokli's heels. It was a routine to which Annie Rourke was now well used. The helicopter began to hover, then seemed to skid downward and settled just over the helipad, touching down. German soldiers in Arctic gear ran from the heat lamps and toward the helicopter's hatchway. The soldiers proffered hands to assist Annie and Madame Jokli down from the machine. Annie, though she needed no assistance, took it, waiting despite the cold on the snow-slick tarmac for Madame Jokli to disembark. Then, together, huddled in their shawls, they walked on the arms of German soldiers from the icy blast into the yellow warmth. Annie passed through the open airlock-like door after the Icelandic president, then stepped over the second flange, and at last inside. In here, Annie was warm, and she slipped her shawl completely down. She followed Madame Jokli along the corridor, an officer, a lieutenant, joining them and ushering them along. The matters of diplomacy were none of Annie's concern unless requested by Madame Jokli to assist. There had been no such whispered remark aboard the helicopter this day.
If it's all right, madam, I'll visit with Dr. Munchen while you confer with Major Volkmer.
Yes, child.
Annie entered the medical laboratory section off the main corridor and started across it. There were ranks of test tubes, retorts, and burners, and lab-coated men and women, German military and civilian, working here. A few, whose faces she recognized, nodded, smiled, then returned to their work. She returned their greetings, stopping before Dr. Munchen's office. Dr. Munchen stood at the door.
Frau Rubenstein, I anticipated you.
Herr Dr. Munchen, may I?
Of course, my dear.
Dr. Munchen took her shawl.
You'll find it, if anything, a bit overwarm today. They are still balancing the system.
Dr. Munchen held a chair out for her on the side of the desk opposite his, and she sat, folding her hands into her lap.
Coffee, my dear?
Yes, thank you.
Annie took the cup and saucer, holding it, as she had learned to hold a teacup, as though it were fragile. But indeed these were not, made of something that was apparently plastic but felt like china.
More discussions, then. Is there word of your father, my dear?
Not unless you've heard anything. My father and my husband were still with the main body of troops when the last regular report was relayed to us, and Michael was still substantially ahead of them. I wish I were there with them.
But you cannot be.
When we talk like this, Herr Doctor, are you psychoanalyzing me?
What would you prefer that I say?
The truth?
The truth. You are so remarkably well adjusted that you amaze me. And without being rude, I hope, I suppose, I am more than curious.
Women have to be well adjusted. They can't afford the same luxuries as men.
You were little more than an infant when what you called the night of the war took place. You were shunted from one place to another by truck, by horseback, saw incredible violence, then slept for almost 5 centuries, and all but raised yourself, all but educated yourself.
My brother Michael, he did the same thing.
But perhaps my own sex prejudices me, but a man will adjust more to violence.
Men expect it more, that's all. And anyway, after Daddy found us at the farm where we were hiding out with the resistance, there wasn't really that much more violence. I was too short to see the video monitors that showed what was going on when the sun rose. And I don't remember too much of the other. Before, I mean.
But subconsciously you do, don't you see?
I don't see.
Your subconscious, of course, affects your conscious actions and decisions. Colors your choices, as it were.
Annie Rourke set her cup and saucer on the edge of the desk, returning her hands to her lap, palms up, one inside the other.
You exude tranquility.
Isn't that which men so need in women? Islands of tranquility amid the storm of life.
Is that a quotation, Annie?
No. I think I made it up. But I read so much, perhaps it is. Don't snitch on me.
Snitch?
I think it's time for me to go.
Dr. Munchen rose with her, Annie arranging her clothes. She wondered if she were becoming manipulative.
I shall look forward to our next meeting.
As will I, Herr Dr. Munchen.
Enter!
A male lab assistant half entered the office. Annie allowed Munchen to press her offered hand and left on the heels of the lab assistant, passed along the work area and through the doorway into the corridor, seeing Madame Jochli and the same young German lieutenant at the end of the corridor. Annie quickened her pace. She could see it in the set of Madame Jochli's mouth. There was something wrong. The flight aboard the helicopter had been quiet, fast, uneventful. Annie lost in thought. Considering one's own nature was difficult. When the helicopter returned to the grassy parkway near the presidential residence, which also served as the meeting place of the Alping, Madame Jochli turned to Annie.
Annie, would you come with me, please?
Annie merely nodded, having expected the request. As she walked beside Madame Jochli, the quite pretty older woman began to speak.
Major Volkmer relayed to me some rather alarming news.
Is it something with Paul, or my father, or Michael, or Natalia?
No, but it is related directly to their actions. Not those of Michael, I understand. But your father, Dr. Rourke. He and the others apprehended several prisoners from among the Russians whom they've been pursuing. I was given to understand that intelligence data found among the prisoners, or extricated from them by means of drugs, Major Volkner wasn't specific in that area, suggests a major attack on our community, and very soon. I fear great loss of life on all sides. I fear it greatly.
Madame Yokley stopped before the low steps of the presidential residence, turned, and faced Annie.
I was asked to leave my residence here and take refuge with our German friends at their base. I told them I could not, while one of the people of Lidwilded Island was unable to do the same. Major Volkmer commended me. He will spare as many troops as possible to assist in our defense, but sees the base as being the most desirable strategic objective. Therefore, it must be defended. I would consider it a personal favor, Annie, if you and your fine mother would take refuge at the German base. Major Volkmer asked that I offer his hospitality to you both. He mentioned that you or your mother would be the ultimate strategic prize for a Soviet offensive. Logic dictated that no argument could be given in that regard.
I'm sure that I speak for both my mother and myself. We will stay unless you directly order us to leave. We can help with the defense. And if the Russians are able to take over Hekla, we wouldn't be much safer at the German base, I don't think.
All right, Annie. As you wish. I will summon the head of our police and then make a general announcement to the community and see to it that word is spread among the other communities as well, that they should be prepared should the Russians attack them as well.
I don't think that they'll do that. Divide their forces, I mean.
Then you'll have work to do, Annie.
Yes, ma'am.
Annie turned now, walking back along the path. There was a great deal to do. John Rourke had finally slept for 7 hours, angry that Natalia or Paul had not awakened him sooner, but forgiving of their motives. He sat now beneath a rocky overhang around a German military portable heater unit, eating from a bag of German field rations and listening as Captain Hartmann discoursed on the intelligence data gleaned so far from the Soviet prisoners.
The attack against Hekla seemed, of course, inevitable. In addition to alerting Major Volkmer, I have also alerted our forces with the Eden Project base in Georgia. I believe that Marshal Karamazov plans to attack at several locations using those forces not already joined with him in the possible hope of drawing us away from the main body of his force.
What about the possibility of an attack on New Germany itself?
Colonel Mann has been alerted as well. He has placed our forces on alert.
I doubt Karamazov would attack in Argentina, Iceland, and Georgia simultaneously.
John Rourke looked at Paul and nodded.
I'm in full agreement. It won't take much to cause grief for Eden Base. Likely, Karamazov's forces will send in as few people as they can get away with to go against Eden, because they'll need substantial forces to go against Hekla. Hekla and the German base outside Hekla are considerably more defensible. There's been no sign of Karamazov bleeding all forces from his main body of troops, and if that pattern holds, that means he'll be relying on the forces he already has in the field under his commanders. And there's no telling what the loyalty situation is among Karamazov's people now, after his attack on the Soviet underground city. He's not going to want to dissipate his forces while the possibility exists for defection. And he hasn't been able to hand his people a victory. And the attacks we've been running, although militarily ineffectual, have to have been demoralizing. I'm becoming more convinced that Karamazov has some definite goal which he's drawing closer to, and he sees it as some sort of panacea for his current situation. It can only be one thing.
The Chinese.
Yeah. Obviously, he has some additional intelligence data from before the night of the war, which has led him to believe that some substantial advantage lies to the east. He still has the gas, but without a base from which he can manufacture more of the substance, the scope of its use is rather limited. I think we're talking nuclear weapons.
That would be insanity, Dr. Rock.
Vladimir is insane.
If a stockpile of Chinese nuclear weapons exists, and since the Chinese, as far as everything I've learned of the aftermath of the night of the war seems to attest, utilized only tactical nuclear weapons in their land war against the Soviet Union, the rest of their nuclear arsenal was unused when the great conflagration took place. If some of it could be made usable, as I'm sure it could, he'd be master of the earth, which is what he wants anyway.
But the Soviet underground city would be insusceptible to nuclear attack, as would...
Your mountain in Argentina, Captain?
Yes, Doctor.
Structurally, yes. But if you could never go outside again, never? I wouldn't be like before. There was always the hope.
Of seeing the sunlight, feeling the wind again.
Yeah, that.
But such a rash act. Another nuclear war. It might well destroy all life, making the planet forever uninhabitable.
There's a line from Paradise Lost.
Better to reign in hell than serve in heaven.
The darkness was something John Rourke could almost feel against his skin as he walked silently, Paul and Natalia flanking him toward the waiting German gunship, its main rotor tossing almost lazily. Natalia boarded the aircraft first, Paul following after her. John Rourke tossed his backpack inside, staring around him for a moment, studying the night. Rourke squinted against the downdraft, feeling his hair caught in it, running his left hand back across his high forehead, the fingers splaying in his hair, pushing it back from his face. He jumped aboard, the German pilot looking back toward him as Rourke slid the fuselage door closed. Rourke gave a thumbs-up signal. The helicopter swept across the snow-splotched rocky landscape, upward. Rourke settled into the bench seat at Natalia's right, Paul Rubinstein sitting at her left.
I'm worried about Annie. And Sarah, too. Ever since...
Madison.
Yeah.
We'll be there in time. Major Volkmer seems to be a competent commander. The Russians won't have an easy victory out of him. And Annie and Sarah are very good at taking care of themselves.
Ever since Madison died, I've realized that all of us... I suppose I should have realized it before, but we are living on borrowed time.
And we always have been. We survived World War III. We survived the burning of the atmosphere. We survived more battles than I would have ever thought possible.
Then why, John? Why are we still alive? And Madison is dead. There is no justice.
Did you ever wonder, Natalia and Paul, did you guys ever wonder why we did survive? I mean, all of that?
What do you mean? You mean, is there some kind of...
Purpose? I don't know. We did what we did because we had to, didn't we? And because we wanted to. Maybe that was the most important thing, wanting it. I mean, we never wanted the killing and the fighting, but we all sort of wanted what came afterward.
Do you think we'll ever find what comes afterward, John? Do you think we'll still recognize it if we ever do find it? I mean, sometimes it is very hard... Would we still recognize it?
Captain Dmitry Pavornin considered it a challenge. A small force against heavily entrenched enemy forces, small in number but well equipped. It was the least important of the two prongs of attack ordered by the hero Marshal Karamazov. But it could be important for him, Pavornin knew. If he could distinguish himself here, if only. The sun had long ago set. He glanced at the chronometer on his wrist. It was nearly time for the attack to begin. Pavornin walked across the open expanse of the staging area. It was desert here, inhospitable dunes of coarse sand, shifting and blowing in the wind, a wind pummeling his face now with grains of sand which stung like sleet. He checked the timepiece again, starting toward his command helicopter. He would use it to join those elements of his forces already moving up on foot for the ground attack against Eden Base. Akira Kuranami had been attempting to see Commander Dodd since word had first been disseminated to expect a Soviet attack. And Dodd, Kuranami had determined several hours ago, had been trying equally as hard to avoid him. Kuranami looked at his wristwatch. Elaine would be worried that he had not returned, but Kuranami felt that if he abandoned his vigil outside Dodd's command tent, all chance of seeing Dodd before the attack began would probably be lost. Just then, Commander Dodd exited his tent, with him one of the German officers.
Commander, I must speak with you, Commander Dodd.
I'm really very busy, Lieutenant Kuranami, with this impending attack and all. Tomorrow?
This can't wait, Commander.
Kuranami stood his ground. Dodd seemed to weigh his words, then waved the young German officer on with a salute. The German returned it and moved off, Dodd's smile fading as he spoke.
Now, Lieutenant, what is so important that it takes precedence over the defense of Eden Base at a moment of crisis such as this?
2 dozen assault rifles and 3,000 rounds of ammunition. 2 lots of botanical samples and about 15% of available emergency rations. And lighting medical supplies. We have a problem, sir.
I don't understand, Akiro. I mean, what are you trying to say?
Missing, sir. All of what I mentioned and more. No accounting of its whereabouts. And the master onboard computer was used, and the file which contained the locations of all the supply caches was blanked. The computers on all the other shuttles were similarly altered.
What are you saying, man?
I made backup files.
Thank God for that. These backup files. What prompted you to make them?
I felt the locations of the supply caches were so important that if something should happen to the shuttles, with a set of backup files, we could always get the Germans to modify one of their computers to bring up the data.
Good thinking, Lieutenant. Thank God you're on the ball. Where are these files?
I don't know if I want to let that information out, sir.
That could make you a very powerful man, Akiro.
It could make someone very powerful, Commander. Someone who wanted to be very powerful.
Yes, exactly. Don't get yourself killed when the attack comes, Akiro. Should the files be lost, well, I shudder to think what Eden Base might do without them.
The Germans would help us.
Oh, I'm sure they would. You're sure it wasn't a miscount, then? Something wrong in the inventory?
I'm sure.
Perhaps we have a saboteur among us.
Or a revolutionary.
Damn it!
The zipper on Sarah Rourke's faded blue Levi's would not close no matter how she tried to suck in. It was the baby. She felt stupid going into battle wearing a dress, but it was either that or wear nothing but panties. She backed toward the bed, plopped down, and started skinning the blue jeans off her legs.
Shit.
Sarah walked toward the greenway, which dominated the center of the Hecla community. She could see Annie ahead of the Icelandic police unit that they laughingly called the SWAT team. She stopped at the edge of the knot of Icelandic police. Annie turned and looked at her.
Hi, Mama.
The Symphony in Blue, reporting for duty, ma'am.
Beyond Annie, others of the German advisors were marshaling more of the Icelandic constabulary, while some of the actual German units sent to assist in the defense of Hecla were disappearing in the distance toward the rim of the volcanic cone.
German or American?
Annie gestured toward the stacked assault rifles near her.
I'm a traditionalist. American.
Annie Rourke had determined that the more experienced of the Icelandic personnel, counting herself and her mother and the 2 Germans who had aided in the training, could best serve the defensive needs of Hecla by guarding the president, Madame Jokli. Annie cradled the M16 in her left arm as she walked along the porch at the height of the main entrance steps. So far, there had been no sounds of gunfire, but soon there would be. Annie suddenly thought of her mother. For Sarah Rourke to have shown up for battle dressed as she was meant that blue jeans no longer fit. Annie wondered if she would soon have a little brother or little sister. And she wondered how her mother felt about the whole thing, because Sarah never really talked about it, and Annie felt she shouldn't ask. She decided, on the spot, as she turned and started back across the porch in the direction from which she had come, that when she next saw her husband Paul, she would ask him if he felt she should try to talk with her mother about the pregnancy, or just wait to be invited to talk about it. Paul was sensitive to this sort of thing, and gave her good counsel. He always gave good counsel, and he was cute. Sometimes she missed the glasses he used to need to wear. Once she had even asked him to put them on for her because she knew he always carried them with him just in case somehow the regenerative effect of the cryogenic sleep instantly wore off and he found himself needing the glasses again to see. Annie Rourke Rubinstein thought of her mother again, of her mother being pregnant. Annie wanted Paul's baby, but they had agreed not until the world was rid of Karamazov and it would be safe to have a child, to bring a new life into the world. She shifted the M16, carrying it at the pistol grip in her right fist. She thought she heard a sound from the greenway at the center of the community, just beyond the last step. She didn't change her pattern of movement. To do so, if an enemy were present, would be to invite a shot. The Jubig Pifel had heard the sound too, and with his eyes he telegraphed it to her. Annie didn't move her head, but let her eyes follow his out toward the greenway. Had it been movement? There was still no gunfire from the rim of the volcano.
Ludwig, awful quiet, isn't it?
Yes, Frau Rubinstein. It is very quiet.
Annie stopped where the porch rail began and looked deliberately down into the greenway. She saw nothing. She felt something. She closed her eyes, trying to focus her concentration. She felt the men out there. Her gift, if indeed it was that, was not so well honed as for her to be able to tell numbers, even see them. But she felt their presence, many men. And she felt a mixture of anger, hatred, and fear. Sergeant Pfeifel had a radio set with which he could contact the defenders at the rim of the volcano, the two German countersnipers in place, precariously on the roof of the presidential residence.
I want you to alert the snipers on the roof, and then the forces at the rim. We have company.
Pfeifel raised his eyebrow and smiled for an instant, and then moved to reach the radio. Automatic weapons fire tore into the porch itself. Annie stabbed the M16 through an opening in the porch rail. Annie heard the snipers open fire on the enemy. She shifted the M16 to her left hand, outstretching her right arm, balling her tiny fist into the uniform tunic of Sergeant Pfeifel. But she knew already that he was dead, and the wide-open stare that she had seen too often before confirmed that. She released the grip on his uniform and moved her hand down toward his utility belt, going for the radio. They'd hear the gunfire at the rim, she told herself, but they wouldn't hear it if there were a battle over.
On the roof! Call for help! Use your radios!
Annie recoiled as the body of one of the countersnipers plummeted past her from the roof above. Captain Pavornin had given the attack signal, and the gunship which would transport him forward to join the ground assault team was airborne now. Some of the German mini-tanks already in motion, Pavornin's gunships firing their rockets. The German armor was tough.
This is Pavornin. Lieutenant Oshkolnikov, bring up the left flank. Quickly, and get your grenadiers and missile men into position. Heavy concentration on the German mini-tanks coming right at you.
Pavornin was beginning to reconsider joining Sergeant Borov with the right flank. A trio of German gunships was coming at him now. Pavornin elbowed the pilot opposite him.
There!
Pavornin suddenly felt very naked in his gunship.
Take me away from here now!
His pilot nodded rather than replying through the headset radios they both wore. He glanced back. The door gunner was strafing the German counterattack below. The pilot wasn't using his missiles, not yet. The helicopter rose, then fell, then rose again, the streak of a missile contrail just passing beneath their chin bubbles. Akira Kuranami spoke into his headset radio.
The Russian pilot is trying to avoid us. I wonder why. Ed, go high.
He dodged the chopper down and to starboard, now giving the German gunship maximum acceleration, feeling himself pushed back into the pilot seat as he climbed the machine, the G-force pressing against his chest. The Soviet gunship rotated 180 degrees on its axis, hesitating for a split second with the advancing Soviet lines. Kuranami worked the safety release for his starboard missiles, punching the button as he leveled off. The chin bubble of Kuranami's helicopter smudged suddenly black with the explosion of the Soviet craft. Kuranami banked his machine hard to starboard.
All right. It has our people on the ground.
Annie Rubinstein had no way of knowing if a radio message had gotten out to the rest of the defenders, and even if it had, whether or not reinforcements could be expected to arrive on time. Five of the Icelandic police remained alive with her there on the front porch of the presidential residence. Though one of them was bleeding badly from a shoulder wound, another's face cut from a spray of rock chips.
All right, you and you, cover us. You three, with me, now!
Annie was up, and she vaulted the railing and dropped toward the ground. Annie quickly got to her feet. The three Icelandic police were just behind her. Annie shouted to the other two police.
Stick close!
Annie dodged left, into a zigzagging run at a tangent toward the arc of Soviet gunfire, throwing herself down just inside the borderline of the greenway. One of the Icelandic police was beside her, firing out his assault rifle. The second, a few feet to her left, behind the trunk of a tree, up on one knee, still firing. The Soviet attackers broke from cover and stormed forward. Suddenly, the pattern of gunfire changed. A heavy concentration from behind her, and she looked back. Her mother and three more of the Icelandic police and the German corporal were coming in two units from both sides of the presidential palace. Her mother led two of the Icelandics, and the German corporal led the other. Some of the Soviet attackers started to go down, their attacking wedge broken. Others dodged for cover.
Now!
Annie was up and running. She emptied the assault rifle into two of the Russians, then slapped the muzzle into the face of a third. Her right hand snatched the Scoremaster from the holster on her right side as she turned half to her left. Annie looked behind her, her mother gut-shooting a Russian officer as he turned toward her to fire. Sarah Rourke snapped the rifle up and left and fired it out, shouting across the din of battle.
Not bad for a pregnant lady who's busting out of her blue jeans, huh?
There were flashes in the darkness, the sweep of searchlights, the brilliant bursts of light from explosions. John Rourke was ready by the open gunship door, holding onto one of the safety straps with his left hand, his M16 in his right fist, the hood of his parka up against the cold. The German base loomed ahead. The German gunship banked toward the interior of Hekla itself, which had to be the ultimate Soviet objective in the attack.
When they let us out, you and Paul cover me. I'll take the grenade launcher.
Agreed.
There were explosions behind them now, and explosions and pinpoint lights of small arms fire in the distance ahead by the crater rim. Rourke's plan was a simple one. Insert behind the main body of the attacking Soviet force and counterattack from the rear. The gunship going airborne again and strafing the Soviet line, attempting for radio contact with the German and Icelandic defenders at the rim of the volcano to start a second wave counterattack. The helicopter was steadily dropping, the land beneath it steadily rising, the effect unnerving slightly as Rourke's eyes surveyed the battlefield they fast approached at the rim of the cone. The main body of Soviet forces, and hence the main thrust of the Soviet attack against the Hekla community, seemed concentrated against the face of the cone nearest the German base. A poor move, Rourke felt subjectively.
Bring her down now.
The pilot made a hand signal showing recognition, Natalia joining John Rourke at the fuselage door, holding on to the same safety strap that he did. Paul Rubinstein wedged himself just inside the door as he pulled up his parka hood, then re-gripped the M16s. The German MP-40 submachine gun was strapped to and snugged tight against his chest. The helicopter was nearly down, but attracting no noticeable attention from the rear of the Soviet lines as it swept in. The chopper skimmed the glacier-crusted surface now, stopping abruptly to hover in midair, then seemed to skid into touchdown. Paul and Natalia jumped out side by side as Rourke glanced back. Rourke worked the safety tumbler of the M16 to full auto, shouldering the rifle, waiting. He glanced right across the snowfield, the light nearly bright enough to read now that the clouds above, which had darkened the sky during most of their journey from Europe, had broken to reveal a three-quarters full moon. Natalia nodded and Paul loosed one of his M16s, gave a hand signal, and then shouldered the other assault rifle. Natalia fired into the core of the Russian rear. Bodies sailed into the night sky, plummeting downward, in whole or in fragments, a puff of orange-tinged white smoke belching upward. Rourke touched his finger to the trigger. He blew out the entire magazine, bodies falling as the Russians rushed their position. Rourke was up on his feet, spraying out the entire magazine. Paul was up, an M16 blazing from each hand, the guns on full auto. Rourke changed the sticks for the M16 again and started forward around the edge of the crevasse. Rourke's footing was suddenly gone and he was plummeting downward into the crevasse. The impact of the explosions had forced apart the crevasse and the ice bridge had disintegrated beneath his feet. Rourke's body skidded downward. The space surrounding him narrowed dramatically with each foot, the light ebbing even faster. His left hand tore steel from leather. The grain knife bit deep into the ice, his shoulders and neck taking the shockwave as it engulfed his body, his full weight with its acceleration abruptly stopping. The darkness was near total. He couldn't shout, he could barely breathe. Rourke's right foot was wedged into the crevasse, and he realized that had he fallen any further, he would have broken the foot or dislocated his hip. He flexed the toes of his right foot inside his combat boots. They were numb with cold and pain, but moved. His left shoulder was screaming at him to let go of the knife as he pried his boot free, struggling for a new, less punishing purchase against the glass-smooth wall of glacial ice, which could at any moment close above and around him, entombing him. Rourke's right hand moved slowly along the ice toward the bottom edge of his Arctic parka, then raising it, his gloved hand searching against the small of his back, near his right kidney. He found the vastly smaller knife he always carried. Rourke tested his weight against both knives. Both knives held. He began to pull himself up, his shoulder seeming to burn with the pain. There were times he wished he were still Michael's age. He had his shoulders to the level of both knives, holding on with his left hand to the larger handle of the grain knife. He pushed himself upward to maximum extension of his arms, nearly locking his elbows. Rourke ripped the little Russell knife free of the ice with his right hand, and as his left elbow locked, his grip started to go. He stabbed the smaller knife into the ice above him. He started pulling himself up on the little Sting 1A black chrome, getting his left foot up onto the hollow handle of the Grain Life Support System 10. He stood, catching his breath, the knife not shifting beneath him. The little Sting 1A had a ring through its butt for attachment to a lanyard. Rourke shifted slightly on his purchase, with his left hand grasping at the sling of the M16. The sling was not made to be removed one-handed, but he started working at it, prying, the sling being of the clip type rather than one which threaded through the swivels and was bound by the buckle. He had one clip all but free. Free now, the rifle starting to slip away. He caught the end of the sling with his teeth. With his left hand, Rourke caught up the rifle and loosed the sling from his teeth. It was the waste of a perfectly serviceable M16, but there was nothing else for it. He held the M16 between his legs, working loose the other clip, which was at the buttstock. He had it as the rifle slipped away into the darkness of the abyss below. He reached up his left hand, snapping the sling into the hole at the base of the skeletonized handle of the Sting 1A. Rourke started feeding the slack in the sling through the buckle to give himself as much length as possible with the sling. Using the massive Grain Life Support System 10, he would gouge into the ice surface while hanging by one hand from the sling attached to the little Sting 1A, then get a foothold and raise himself up, then re-grasp the sling and free the grain knife, then repeat the process all over again. A third knife would have made it easier. Pitons made it almost a practical means of traverse. John Rourke reached the maximum extension, his booted feet balanced on the handle of the grain knife. His right hand wrenching out the Sting 1A. Then his right arm extended upward, driving the knife into the ice like a stake into the heart of a vampire. He pulled himself up a little further. Rourke repeated the process. Drive the smaller knife into the ice, swing from the sling, wrench out the larger knife, and then drive it into the ice. Then climb up to stand upon it, then begin again. As he rose to perch precariously again on the handle of the grain knife, his head impacted something above him. Ice.
Oh, Jesus.
He was trapped. Sarah Rourke watched Annie, praying for the child. The gift the girl had was also a curse, perhaps more a curse than a gift at all.
I can feel him, Mama. He's trapped. He's in darkness. He's never been so tired. I can feel him thinking about us and never seeing us again. Oh, Mama!
Sarah Rourke held her daughter tightly in her arms. They were trapped under enemy fire, had no radio. We're still at least a quarter mile from the rim. Rourke had said a word, which said it all. Moaned the word like pain. Ice.
John!
Natalia Anastasia Tiamarovna felt something.
Johnny?
She looked at Paul Rubinstein beside her, crouched near the height of the cone. Russians in front of them, some still behind them. The defenders of Hekla counterattacking now. Natalia and Paul pinned down. Natalia closed her eyes.
Where's John?
Where the hell is he?
Annie.
He was sealed in the crevasse. The ice could have been feet thick or only inches thick. He didn't know which. Rourke stood, balanced on the handle of the grain knife, his legs cramping because he couldn't move them, his feet falling asleep, losing all sensation. With the AG Russell Sting 1A, he chiseled at the ice over his head. The ice was chipping away, but piteously slowly. The walls of ice groaned again. The last time, they had made it such that he could not keep both shoulders level and still be able to move freely. This time, it confined him still more.
Motherfucker!
He stopped hammering. His strength, his very ability to raise his hands all but ebbed away. The next time the walls closed, he would be crushed or forced to drop downward, abandoning any hope of survival. But his will had not ebbed away. John Rourke wrapped the sling carefully around the blade of the Sting 1A and pocketed it. Clinically, his years of firearms expertise summoned up as though he were punching up a file in a computer. The .357 Magnum over the .45 AGP had the greatest hydrostatic shock value. It would be the Python then. He wasn't looking to knock down the ice, but rather to burst through it. Rourke took his dark-lensed aviator-style sunglasses from an interior pocket, placed them over his eyes. He thrust the Python upward, the muzzle pointed by feel. Rourke removed his sunglasses, looking up. He could barely detect that some larger chunks of ice were shot away. Still no opening into the Arctic night above him. Rourke worked the cylinder release catch, thumbing it rearward with his trigger finger, pushing out the cylinder, shaking the revolver over the abyss, the empty brass falling away. He felt in one of the Musette bags, finding one of the Safariland speed loaders. Rourke closed the cylinder, taking the revolver again in his right fist. The ice wall shuddered, closing around him again. Rourke turned sideways, the walls against his chest and back. The python was empty. John Rourke looked up. Moonlight. Rourke rammed the python into the full flap holster at his right hip, closing the flap so he wouldn't lose the revolver. He let his feet slip from the handle of the grain knife, using almost the last of his strength to pry it free from the ice. Rourke threw his arms up sideways in a ragged arc and thrust the knife into the ice overhead. He pulled himself up, still holding to the sling with his right hand. He pulled, his head pushed through the crack in the ice. The crevasse was shuddering closed. John Rourke wrenched the grain knife free of the ice as he thrust his upper body into the sub-zero night, a strange warmth rushing over him. He rolled his body free, his legs barely responding, jerking at the sling which was still attached to the rustle knife, the smaller knife arcing up and out of the crevasse as the crevasse sealed the ice beneath.
American!
Rourke saw the man, one of the Soviet assault rifles in both the man's fists, the man less than 6 feet away, leveling the rifle to fire. Rourke snapped his left hand and arm forward as he rolled toward the man, his left hand loosing the haft of the Grain System 10. Paul Rubinstein had elected to go, Natalia providing covering fire for him with two of the M16s. Friendly forces too close for use of the grenade launcher.
Ready?
Ready!
No!
Paul Rubinstein pushed up from the crouch and sprinted away from the rocks behind which they had taken cover. He was making his way toward the sparsest portion of the enemy resistance behind them, going back to look for John Rourke. Natalia told him that somehow she had sensed Annie, and somehow she sensed that something was wrong with John. She didn't know how or why. He kept running, nearly clear of enemy fire now, a few straggling Soviet soldiers still to be seen, some fewer of them wounded.
John! John Rourke! Where are you, John?
Paul saw something, far to his right, farther away from the volcanic cone. The clothing color was wrong for the Soviet troopers or even the Germans. White snow smock, but part of it pulled up, black winter gear revealed beneath it in the moonlight. The body tall, even fully reclined as it was. A man well over 6 feet in height, long limbed.
Shit! John!
Paul Rubinstein let the assault rifle fall to his right side on its sling.
John!
The face was gray, seemingly lifeless. John Rourke's face.
John! John! Answer me! John!
Behind him, he heard movement. Rubinstein wheeled there on his knees beside the best friend he had ever had. There was a dead Russian, a knife impaling him through the chest. The knife John Rourke had started carrying since the last quick trip John and Michael had made to the retreat. Beyond the knife-dead soldier was a figure, moving, then another. Two Russian soldiers, advancing out of the shadow beyond a rising ice ridge. Paul Rubinstein threw his body over that of his friend to protect him, throwing the Schmeisser online with the enemy soldiers.
Die! Fuck you!
Rubinstein drew the battered Browning High Power from the tanker holster beneath his parka as he almost ripped it open, setting the pistol on John Rourke's chest, shrugging out of the jacket, then folding it around John Rourke as he raised his friend's lifeless-seeming form into a sitting position, the body cold, stiff, rigid.
John! Damn it! Answer me, John! Natalia! Help me! It's John! John! Damn it! Don't die!